I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
Good morning. It is 9/12, Wednesday, May 19th. This is the TDN Writers Room, presented by the J.P. Morgan Private Bank. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, trying to navigate this brave new world of trainer accountability.
Good morning, Joe. I'm Bill Finley, the Mid-Atlantic Bureau Chief for the Thoroughbred Daily News. I just made that up.
Jonathan Green, General Manager of DJ Stable. And in the words of Mark Twain, the reports of racing's demise are greatly exaggerated.
Bill, we're going to have to get Alan Foreman back on to see if you can legally hold that title. The TDN Writers Room is presented by the J.P. Morgan Private Bank. J.P. Morgan Private Bank is a proud sponsor of the Writers Room podcast. For over 200 years, we've helped successful individuals and families achieve their unique ambitions. To learn more about us and explore becoming a client, visit privatebank.jpmorgan.com. All right, so after the kind of terrible taste that we had last week after the Derby nonsense, we had the Preakness this past Saturday, and I thought it was a really interesting contradiction in terms of how I felt about the winner, the trainer, and the owner compared to at the Derby. And this is kind of even before the whole drug controversy came out about Medina Spirit. It was just kind of a hard result to really feel good about. It was, like I said at the time, it was kind of like the evil empire finding a way to win at 9-7 or 10-6. But this was, you know, with Ron Bauer winning the Preakness, this was kind of the good side of racing. It was a trainer who has had over 1,000 starters and has never had a single positive drug test, and this was his first Triple Crown starter, and the horse won pretty convincingly. And Michael McCarthy, who we're going to talk to a little bit later, got pretty choked up in the winner's circle and emotional. And you know, that's what we love to see. It's not for guys like that. It's not just, you know, they're not just climbing up the ladder and, you know, just kind of putting notches on the wall for every gigantic race they win. These are guys who kind of, you know, wait their whole life to get this moment and to win big races like that. And that, to me, is what racing is about the relatively smaller trainer who can get to the big stage eventually and prove their mettle. And that's what would happen there. And also the owners, John and Diane Fragkin, who usually don't even own horses to race. This was just kind of a freak tale where they couldn't sell the horse and they kept them. And now here they are in the winner's circle of the Preakness. So those are the kind of stories we really like and really appreciate in racing. And those are the stories that we wish would be broadcast to the world rather than the Bob Baffert drug positive stories of the world. So that kind of struck me, how I felt like it washed kind of the nasty taste of the Derby out of my mouth, at least watching that result. And as far as the horse, you know, he looked the part pre-race. I went into that race like in Crowded Trade, who didn't really run a step. And before the race in the post parade and in the infield, I was like, God damn, Ron Bauer looks incredible, like about to jump out of his skin, incredible, but controlled aggression, controlled, a positive presence, I guess you would say. That's the kind of thing that is very hard to gauge sometimes, but I think John and Bill would agree that horse looked phenomenal in the post parade. Got a great trip. Great ride by Flavian Pratt, who I think, you know, I got to give a shout out, I think is one of the more underrated riders in America, even though he's leading rider consistently out in California. I think he doesn't get the publicity that a lot of the East Coast guys get. And he's, you know, for my money, he gets the most out of his mouth in these big races. And he proved it again. Looks like Ron Bauer is going to run in the Belmont. So we'll get that, somewhat star power in the Belmont. We'll see who else shows up. But those are my initial impressions. Let's hear from you guys.
Yeah. I mean, going back to Ron Bauer, you know, you look at this horse on paper, and to be honest with you, I don't know how anyone came up with him. 13-1 seemed like an underlay to me. And, you know, we're all slaves to the speed figures now. Anybody who looks at speed figures would have concluded within 13 seconds of looking at this horse's record, it really wasn't fast enough to compete with the Medina Spirits and the top members of the division. But the thing that happens, and we see this all the time, three-year-olds can improve so dramatically and so quickly. This horse obviously improved, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 lengths off his best form coming into the Preakness and got the well-deserved win. Joe, everything you said about Mike McCarthy and the owners and about, you know, the people that do it right and good story, couldn't agree more with that. You know, it's a shame that their story was kind of washed out or drowned out by the Bob Baffert fiasco. So the other thing we have to do is look at the Baffert horses. I mean, Deacon Spirit ran okay. He was okay. He was third. What about Concert Tour? What was that all about? I mean, I picked him and he was awful, absolutely awful. You know, you'll see Baffert horses get beat, but when do you ever see a Baffert horse just not show up like that? And I don't buy into this theory, but of course, when Baffert's 0-for-4 through the Preakness and also has a clunker in the Black Eyed Susans, obviously people would say, oh, they were testing him, they were watching him, see? That's the problem we have with this sort of thing now.
Yeah, and Baffert's horses were really in a no-win situation. And you know, Bill, I agree. I thought Concert Tour was really, you know, primed for a good start. And he really, you know, flattened out, didn't really run very much in the race at all. But, you know, Medina Spirit, who was the, you know, currently is the Kentucky Derby winner, you know, had not just 126 pounds of, you know, John Velasquez on his back, but he had millions of people, millions of eyeballs and pounds weighing that horse down. And, you know, I, for one, usually don't root for or against, you know, certain horses, you know, during big races like this, because it's such a great, you know, part of racing and breeding. And you want to see those kind of really cool races and great finishes. But I got to tell you that I was rooting against both parts of the Baffert entries for no other reason other than just that he was training them. And, you know, is that right or wrong? Who's to say? But I can tell you that it didn't bother me one bit that when Medina Spirit started to fade down the stretch and got passed, you know, by Midnight Bourbon and Rombert, you know, respectfully. So I thought overall it was kind of a, you know, yay for the good guys of the business. Certainly, you know, the owner and the breeder and the trainer, certainly all were deserved. And it's a great story that a small organization and a smaller, you know, non-super trainer won the Preakness. I think that's great for racing. I think it's a great story. And you know, we'll have Mike McCarthy on later on to talk to him about, you know, some of the emotion that he showed, you know, and rightfully so in winning a big race like this. But I think overall, it was really positive for the industry that this result occurred. And that hopefully, you know, once we get to the Belmont, we're not going to be talking as much about what's going on with, you know, with the Baffert trained horses. Although there's the specter that the split sample results, you know, will be publicized or, you know, are scheduled to be publicized, hopefully right around Belmont time. So, I mean, it'd be good for ratings, but man, I we want all this to be in our rearview mirror as we're going through the rest of the Triple Crown races and into the summer and some of the really big $1 million grade ones that these 3-year-olds will be campaigning in.
Yeah. And I was kind of rooting against the Baffert horses too. And, you know, I thought it was kind of interesting that, you know, I was interested to see how NBC would cover it on the broadcast, because you don't want to make the entire broadcast around Baffert, about Baffert and the drug positive, but you don't want to, you know, not mention it and gloss over it as well. I thought it was, like I said, it was a smart decision by Baffert to stay home and not be a distraction. But I thought they did a good job. I thought Tim Layden was, you know, kind of remarkably honest about the whole thing. You know, he does those little vignette pieces leading into the race, and he didn't mince any words. He basically said, like, this is unacceptable. Racing has to do better. Bob Baffert has no excuses. So I thought that was really interesting. And then when they came out of it, Mike Tirico and Jerry Bailey and Randy Moss had an honest conversation about the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act and what kind of stuff that racing can do to clean itself up. And they also did immense words and said, basically, it's now or never to clean up the sport. And, you know, I kind of agree with that. So, you know, overall, I don't know. It's obviously a bad story that the Medina Spirit thing happened and got so much attention. And, you know, I don't know if you guys can throw up a still of this or whatever, but Beck Bennett on Saturday Night Live doing the Bob Baffert impression, I thought was pretty damn funny. And you know, I guess we figured out what it takes for racing to get on Saturday Night Live. But so as bad of a story as that was for racing, I think, you know, we're going to talk about this in a little bit, the kind of the trickle down results of it. I think it might be a good thing because it was such a national embarrassment, like even bigger than the FBI indictments. Like, this was a bigger story because everybody pays attention to the Derby. So in the end, I think this actually might end up being a good thing in terms of sunlight being the best disinfectant and all that. But yeah, the Baffert horses stunk over the weekend. And you know, it's a small sample size. It was only, you know, Medina Spirit still ran third. Concert Tour was awful, like Bill said. Beautiful Gift was bad in the Black Eyed Susan. So, I mean, small sample size or no, it's kind of interesting that, you know, they have this extra scrutiny. They have these extra blood tests and none of the horses run a step. I don't know. There was a horse on Sunday at Santa Anita, first time starter for $1.3 million that, you know, was bet down to 6-5, really didn't run a step either. Now, all of this might be coincidence, but I wonder if there's going to be more scrutiny on the Baffert horses. If, you know, he's going to lose that 25-30%, you know, win percentage that he has right now. But at the end of the day, like I said, it was a good palate cleanser. I think the Preakness result, you know, relative to the Kentucky Derby result, and obviously there's going to still be fallout from the Derby, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But you know, it was nice, you know, within that 1 week span to see the good parts of racing and the kind of what the good guys in racing all aspire to, that you can have, you know, just a couple of horses or, you know, a good stable, but not what you would say an elite stable, but you can still get to that elite podium and your horse can do you right. So that was my takeaway from the race. You know, elsewhere, I'm looking forward to the Belmont. We're going to talk a little bit about Baffert being suspended by Naira in a few, but I wonder how much of an effect that's really going to have on the Belmont. I wonder if there's going to be, you know, I don't know who Baffert was going to enter in the Belmont, if anybody, but I wonder if without the specter of Bob Baffert, if we're going to get more entries in the Belmont Stakes and on the Belmont undercards. But, you know, overall, like I said, we felt good about the Preakness. And you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm all yelled out after last week. I was like, I got on my yelling out last week. This is the newcomer, Joe Bianca. And I want to thank everybody for the feedback from last week's show. I think a lot of people really appreciated that. But you know, we're not gonna banish Bob Baffert into the ether forever. There's still gonna be a lot of discussion about him. But this is, I feel like the industry is kind of trying to pivot away from him and the super trainers. And you know, the one thing I would say is that, you know, he's not the only guy. I said this last week. He's not the only guy who is bending the rules at the top of the game. And, you know, there are some consequences for that coming, I think, eventually. And if you're another top trainer, tick tock to get your stuff together before we have real uniform drug policy coming in. And maybe in the next year. So hopefully, fingers crossed. The TDN Writers Room is co-sponsored by Keeneland, the flexibility to buy and sell year-round, the convenience of an intuitive digital platform, the opportunity to reach a global audience and never leave the farm. No matter your strategy, Keeneland's digital sales ring provides an advantage that's yours for the taking. Backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales, find your digital advantage at the Keeneland May digital sale on Tuesday, May 25th. Visit KeenelandDigital.com for details. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Owning a multiple graded stakes winning racehorse like Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. I want to shout out the sponsor, West Point, for getting the hammer dropped at $1.5 million this week for a quality road colt at Facing Tipton Mid-Atlantic. Congrats to Terry and all the partners out there. You know, it was a huge bidding war between them and Amr Zidan, interestingly enough. And they got the horse they wanted. They got a new partner on the horse. So congrats to you guys making a big splash at Mid-Atlantic. All right, so we kind of alluded to this in the last segment. It was announced this week that Naira has at least temporarily suspended Bob Baffert from entering horses at its racetracks, which includes Belmont Day. Now, we don't know whether or not there was going to be any Baffert horses in the Belmont itself, But we know that Charlatan was pointing towards the Met Mile. He's one of the biggest names in racing. So I thought this took some guts. I saw some criticism from people that I think is valid, that, you know, you wonder whether or not if Medina Spirit had won the Preakness, whether or not they would have made this same decision, because obviously it's a huge moneymaker for Naira and for New York racing. If there's a Triple Crown on the line, so you wonder if maybe that had a little something to do with it. But overall, this was not an easy decision to make, and I think you got to applaud Naira for stepping in and you know, taking charge in this way. But I think this is kind of another reason why we need Heise and why we need uniform enforcement, because it shouldn't be on Naira. It shouldn't be on these racetracks to make this unilateral decision to say, well, you can't run horses here because you had a horse test positive in the Derby for 21 picograms over the limit. Like, it shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be their call to make. There should be a governing body who says you got to go. And if you got to go at one place, you got to go from every single racing jurisdiction. Now, I'm not saying that necessarily Bob Baffert will be one of those guys who are banned completely. Well, like I said, TikTok, there is accountability coming, and you know who you are if you're a big time trainer and you're bending the rules. So I think you kind of got to get your program in order in the next year or so, because like I said last week, the era of no accountability is over, and the era of people accepting drug positives and all of this nastiness and messiness around our sport is over. People have had enough. And I think that's why Naira was forced to make this decision, was public pressure. I don't think necessarily they wanted to make this decision on their own, but they put their ear to the street and realized that, you know, it was going to be a very bad look for most of the racing public if Bob Baffert was running horses on Belmont Stakes Day. So certainly not a no-brainer decision, but I thought it was a good decision for PR, if nothing else. What do you guys think?
Yeah, Joe, a couple points on that. First of all, remember, they banned Baffert, not the horses. So Baffert was not intending, as far as I know, to run anything in the Belmont Stakes. But Charlatan, you're right. Between now and the race, we're obviously going to find out, I would imagine, that he's just going to be moved to another trainer. Now, the other thing they put in there, it can't be the old, oh, just put him in the name of the assistant. So Charlatan or someone else can't just run under the name of Jimmy Barnes. He's going to show up any day now. And, you know, Tad Pletcher's, but matter of fact, he's probably the number one candidate to get the horse. Charlatan will show up in someone's barn. I have one little problem. Well, not a little problem. I have a definite problem with what Naira did. And look, just like everybody else, I bailed from the Bob Baffert bandwagon here. You know, he's been a hard time finding anybody stick up to him, support him. But, you know, we still have in our society, and racing follows certain due process rules. I think it was premature for both Churchill and Belmont to ban him before the split sample came back. I mean, we think it's going to be positive, but what if it's not? I mean, imagine the egg over all over everybody's faces. So, you know, I think that was a little bit unfair. It's like, you know, everyone's almost gone from one extreme to the other, doing nothing to now, you know, like everybody's going to be the new sheriff in town. And you still have to be fair to these people. You still have to go by the general rules of our society. But taking this a step further, and again, like, as I said last week, I think we'll still be talking about this 5 years from now. But if the split sample comes back positive, what will Churchill and Naira do about Baffert going forward? Well, they say after 6 months or so, oh, you've been a bad boy. You've paid your time. Welcome back. Or will they keep these bans in place? If Baffert is not allowed to run in the Kentucky Derby and is not allowed at the New York racetracks, his career is finished. I mean, he would have, few little horses running in California. You know, these $1.5 million yearlings that he gets and two-year-old purchases, they're not going to a guy who cannot run in the Kentucky Derby. So, you know, stay tuned for that one. It's going to be huge ramifications down the road.
The thing that really shocked me about this decision was that the powers that be actually came in very quickly and made a decision, which as an industry, we're not that, you know, adept at doing. We're not known for our quick decision making. And I'm sure they spoke to all their legal counsel and looked at both sides of the equation as far as, you know, if we do put in a ban, if we institute it and it comes back negative, what happens? Do we get sued for restraint of trade, by Baffert at all? Or is it just best overall, you know, from a PR standpoint, Joe, like you said, that we just go ahead and we assume that he's going to be guilty, that it's going to be negative. Excuse me, that the split sample is going to be positive again, and therefore we've eschewed any additional issues. I watched last week's show, And Alan Foreman said something that really blew my mind in the course of the interview. He said, if the split sample results occurred in California, if the Kentucky Derby was actually run in California, that Bob Baffert would have gotten a $500 fine and the purse monies would have been distributed as the horse would not have been disqualified and the purse monies would have been distributed. And I was like, that's unbelievable that, you know, the set of rules are so different. So, you know, Bill, to your point, if Baffert is banned, you know, from New York and Churchill for racing in the future, you're right. He's going to have to go back to a safe haven of California. But I think the winds of change are coming in and, you know, California may be forced to either update their rules or once everything gets under the Heisa umbrella, that everything is going to be, you know, on a uniform set of rules and that it's not going to be kind of a wrap on the wrists as far as a wrap on the knuckles, excuse me, as far as, you know, a small fine and everything, everyone goes on their merry way. So I was really pleased again to see that, you know, that there was some swift decision-making in the industry and that it wasn't an easy call. I don't think that Naira sat around and said, oh, this is a no-brainer. We just ban them. I think that they really went through a lot of the, you know, different scenarios of what could happen based on the test results. And they figured that it was best to kind of rip the Band-Aid off now and make the decision than to let things kind of drag on and drag on. Because, you know, even though in our minds, Medina Spirit didn't run a great Preakness, he still ran third. And you would think that they would still want to run him in the Belmont if they could. So I think Naira had to come in and make a decision almost immediately after the results were done from the Preakness.
Yeah, I mean, as a quick aside, I saw Jimmy Barnes' explanation for why Medina Spirit didn't, you know, got beat 10 lengths or so, and he said the pace was too fast. But if you actually look, the half mile split was slower in the Preakness than it was in the Derby. So I thought that was kind of a flimsy excuse for the way he ran. Yeah, I mean, this is a PR thing. Like, this is, even though I applaud Naira and I think that it did take some guts to do what they did, it's ass covering season, you know, like that's where we've reached in racing right now, where, you know, not speaking about Naira specifically, but just people in general that have kind of let these things go and let these things slide over the years now want to get the positive PR of kind of swiftly getting Bob Baffert out of here. And like Bill said, I, you know, it makes me wonder if they have like insider knowledge of the split sample, because, you know, they could look really bad if the split sample comes back negative. But at the end of the day, like, I don't think for most people, this is about betamethasone and the 21 picograms and Medina Spirit. I think this is a broad swathed reaction to the kind of the whispers about Bob Baffert and all the positive tests over the years. I don't necessarily think that if he's exonerated in this particular case, that there's not going to be reason to have suspicion and to, you know, kind of restrict him from your grounds. The real litmus test to me for whether or not Bob Baffert is going to be, you know, sufficiently permanently punished or exiled is California and some of his big owners. Those are the people that have the most leverage to punish Bob Baffert. You know, he's not going to run more than a handful of horses in New York throughout the year. He's not going to run more than a handful of horses at Churchill. Obviously, the Derby is a big deal if he's not able to run in that going forward. But overall, he does most of his damage in California, and he attracts these gigantic owners like the Avengers because of it. And, you know, it's all good when, you know, he's winning these huge races, and, you know, he's up until now has been kind of the star of the game. So you have that star power attached to him, but, you know, now it's a little bit more complicated for people. And I think that's a good thing. I think that, you know, owners, overall, I think should be constantly reassessing the trainers that they use and the you know, how they distribute their horses and what tracks they run at. I think owners should be constantly reassessing. And John talked about that last week. You know, they don't run at parks anymore because, you know, the circumstances change where there are certain guys who he feels, you know, you can't beat. It can go the other way too, where, you know, if you're winning all of these races, obviously you're not going to move away from the track, but, you know, it might attract more scrutiny now than it used to if you're just dominating all these gigantic races. So that to me is going to be the interesting thing going forward, is whether or not the owners jump ship and whether or not California cracks down on Baffert, because the rest of this doesn't have any real practicable daily, day-to-day impact on Bob Baffert and his business. California and those gigantic owners that he has, those are the people that can really affect things. And I wonder if you guys just put on your future predictor hat. What's your forecast? Do you think that this is all going to keep going downhill for Baffert? Do you think he's going to have a stronghold in California and with these big owners?
Well, Joe, I'll go back to what I said before. And you're right. I mean, probably what, 90% of the races he wins are in California. So far, the Stronach Group, Del Mar, Los Alamitos, has not taken any action against him. Though maybe they will. I mean, they could be waiting for the split sample to come back. I don't know. But, you know, this is not, is he going to be Dutrow? Is he going to be drummed out of the business and sent to the sidelines? I kind of doubt that. But no matter what happens, he'll never be the same. Because, you know, this is more than winning the Triple Crown. Winning the Triple Crown twice. This is his legacy. You're the guy that got, whether fair or not, allegedly, we understand, we realize it's not Service Navarro. I mean, all those things that we have to say to be careful here. But he will always go down in history as the guy who allegedly doped a horse to win the Kentucky Derby. Now, that's not, as you, me, and John know, it's not really that simple. But he said before, Joe, the man on the street knows one thing. Somebody cheated to win the Derby. No matter what happens, that's never going to change. So I could see a lot of scenarios. But you talk about the big owners. Churchill Downs is the key, because the people that give Baffert horses, by and large, give him horses with one goal in mind: to win the Kentucky Derby. And if he can't win the Kentucky Derby and can't participate in the Kentucky Derby, the China Horse Clubs, the Windstars of the world, your guys, the Avengers, maybe even Amr Zidane, he's had horses for Godolphin, et cetera. They're not going to give Baffert any more horses.
In this business especially, you know, trainers are such a what have you done for me lately type of a position. So, a trainer of a stature of Bob Baffert, when he's winning big races, he's going to get more owners. He's going to get better horses. He's going to get better bred, more expensive athletes. And the same cycle is on the downwards, trend also. If this does come to fruition and the split sample comes back positive again, I think people are going to continue to migrate away from him, run away from him, quite frankly. And he's not going to get the same kind of caliber of horses. But there will be somebody who down the road is going to look at, you know, the opportunities and say, I can't go to these super trainers because my couple of horses aren't going to be important to them. Wait, Bob Baffert won 6 or 7 derbies and he had 2 Triple Crown winners. And that was such a long time ago. I don't really remember what was, so bad about what he was doing. And now with Heise's rules and everything in place, nobody can really cheat anymore anyway. So I'm going to give him a chance. I think there will be people down the road who will do that because there were some very good trainers that had very good years. And you think of Pat Byrne when he came onto the scene and won a couple of major races, Breeders' Cup races for the Stronachs. And even Dwayne Lucas, who was the Bob Baffert of his time, and got all the best horses and had all the top owners and won every single big race. And eventually, the mantle is handed off to different owners, to different trainers who have different, styles or different opportunities. And the industry continues to go down the road. But I don't think, Joe Orsino and I have known each other for a long time. And Orsino obviously won some big races, Preakness and some Breeders' Cups for the Stronachs. And when he came back into public training, he said to me, John, I don't care if you give me your good horses. I just want to make sure that I'm not standing at Gulfstream Park with a purple jacket, greeting the high rollers and saying, I'm Joe Orsino. I used to train, big horses. I don't think it's going to be a situation like that for Bob Baffert. I don't think he's going to be standing at the high rollers room, at Santa Anita, glad handing people and taking them to their table like a maitre d'. But is he going to get the Avengers giving him horses? Is he going to get Spendthrift giving him horses? I think that ship has sailed, at least for the near term.
We'll see. We'll see. I don't know. You might have a little more faith in the big owners than I do. We'll see. We'll see what other ramifications come from the Derby and what other fallout comes from that. But, just a couple of points before we wrap this up. The thing about Michael McCarthy winning the Preakness, I would hope that it reminds people that you don't have to have the guy who wins at 25 to 30% to win big races. Like, I think Baffert winning so many derbies, especially recently, he's won four in like the last 6 or 7 years. I think that, that skewed the perception of people that you have to have these trainers, you have to have these super trainers in order to win the big races. And I think in general, that's not true. Now, it's kind of a self-fulfilling thing where the more horses, more big horses that go to this guy, the better chances he has to dominate these big races. But I just think on a basic level, unless someone is cheating, I think the difference between the top 50 or so trainers in America is pretty small. It's kind of like the top jockeys in America, I think. You know, outside of the top 20, you know, then you get a drop off. But I think the top 15, 20 or 20 or so jockeys, I think they're pretty interchangeable. I think they're all elite. Obviously, they have different strengths, but I think overall, you're not, you know, if you want Irad Ortiz and you get, you know, John Velasquez or Javier, you're not like, oh my God, I'm screwed now. Because there's, you know, there's a presumption that these guys are all competent or all good at their job. You know, with trainers, I feel like there's more of an obsession with getting these big name guys like Bob Baffert and Chad Brown and Brad Cox. But there are a lot of guys who can do the job. And, you know, that needs to be a constant reminder for people that, you know, you don't necessarily have to, you know, get the Bill Belichick of training horses. You can, other coaches win Super Bowls too, guys. And it's not good for the game as a whole if all of the big horses are residing in two or three barns. And that's hopefully one of the things that will happen if we get, you know, real national reform, is there'll be more of a kind of dispersal effect that, you know, guys who were struggling to get horses against these guys like Baffert and Chad Brown, et cetera, are going to have more of a level playing field or more of a chance, you know, to compete on that level, because they certainly are capable. And then one other thing that I think that, you know, Heise might do is kind of reduce the cynicism in people like me and racing fans, because I'm not naturally a cynic. I'm more of an optimistic, glass half full guy. Obviously I'm somewhat suspicious of people being from Brooklyn, but other than that, like I in general want to think the best in people. And but the racing like beats that out of you. You know, if you see a guy winning a ton of races and, you know, a guy winning at 25-30%, even if it's only for a short period of time, your brain starts to wander and think like, well, what is this guy doing? Like, what kind of edge is he taking? Is he cheating? Like, how can we figure that out? Is he ever going to get popped? So that's something that I hope will change amongst the racing public. If we ever have, you know, an enforcement and policy mechanism that we can all at least nominally trust to level the playing field, that you won't have this constant cynicism, because it sucks. It sucks. I want to be able to celebrate everybody. You know, I don't want to just celebrate when certain trainers win. I want to be able to celebrate all the big races and all the big horses and everybody who wins a big race, because, you know, at the end of the day, like we are fans of the game, and we're not here to, you know, be 100% critical all the time. It's just that racing has led us to this point where you can't help but be cynical and critical. And that's one thing that I hope changes, because I think that that's kind of, you know, underreported and not talked about as much as, you know, how much this game beats the optimism and trustingness out of you. You know, you can't help but be cynical and be skeptical. So that's something that I hope changes as well, because I don't want to have to wait for like, oh, well, that guy won that race, I can't feel good about that. That guy won that race, I can't feel good about that. I got to wait like 10 races for someone who I think is not cheating to win a race to feel good and to celebrate it. I think that's one of the things that needs to go away as well. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
This week's TDN Story of the Week is brought to you by the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project. Find out how you can get involved in racehorse ownership at Canterbury Park this summer with several options and investments ranging from $250 to $10,000. Visit racehorseminnesota.com. to learn more. So the story of the week this week is amazingly not about Bob Baffert, but it is about another trainer being disciplined the other day, Linda Rice had her training license immediately revoked for a period of, quote, no less than 3 years. She was fined $50,000 when the New York State Gaming Commission voted 5-0 to agree to a hearing officer's determination that Rice had a years-long pattern of seeking and obtaining confidential pre-race, pre-entry information from NYRA racing office workers, and that this practice was, quote, intentional, serious, and extensive, and that her actions constituted improper and corrupt conduct, inconsistent with and detrimental to the best interests of horse racing. Now, I want to be nuanced here because, you know, I don't want to be a hypocrite and come on here and rail every week about how trainers need to be punished when they break the rules and then say that this wasn't deserved. If this was, as it seems, kind of a years-long strategy by Linda Rice to try to gain an advantage and that other trainers don't have, and then I think that punishment is warranted. The only thing I will say is that it is weird that we've been begging for trainers with drug positives to be punished all these years, and they just never are. They'll get, like, you know, at most a 30-day suspension in which you can run trainer horses in your assistant trainer's name. So it seems a little incongruous is all I'm saying, is that for the hammer to drop on her like this, for this thing, which doesn't affect the safety or the welfare of the animal, which should be the most important thing, I thought was a little, like I said, a little incongruous with the way jurisdictions and gaming commissions treat drug overages. That being said, this does affect racing. This does affect the competition of the game, and it's a shady thing to do. And if indeed that she's been doing this for years and years and years, she theoretically has had warnings along the way that, like, Linda, you got to cut this out. And she continued to do it. She allegedly was giving money and gifts to people in the racing office who then would give her information about, and even sometimes past performances, pre-entry, about who was pointing towards a race. The other thing I have to say about this before I toss it to Bill is that there's a little bit of a gray area here, because, you know, the idea that no trainers ever have any inkling of who's going to enter a race before the entries draw, that's nonsense, because there are times when, you know, a race is struggling to fill. You have three or four horses, need five or six, and the racing office will call trainers up to try to hustle entries to fill the races. And you're not going to be able to do that without, you know, leaking some information about who's pointing to the race. So with that in mind, I think, while I do agree that she deserved to be punished for this, it's a little murky for me, because the idea that nobody ever knows anything pre-entry about who's going to run in a race, that's definitely not true. But I'm wondering what Bill and John have to say.
You know, Joe, I think this is fairly simple and straightforward. And I know what everyone's saying and what you're saying, that, you know, after all the ridiculousness of letting all these bad trainers and guys that are breaking the rules and really doing nothing about it, you know, it seems, you know, hypocritical that you go after somebody, give them a huge penalty for something that, you know, is not as serious, obviously, as drugging a horse. But it doesn't matter. The rules are very clear, very straightforward. She apparently did this for a long, long time, and she broke the rules. It wasn't right. So, you know, they decided that she broke the rules and has to take 3 years off and be suspended for 3 years. I'm sure she's going to appeal, but, you know, eventually I'm sure she will have to take these kind of days. You know, Linda Rice is a very good trainer, nice person, and everybody likes her and everything like that. But the bottom line is, if these facts are real, and we believe that they are, she cheated. She cheated in a different way of putting a syringe in a horse's butt and pumping him up with SGF 1000 or something like that. But nonetheless, she did cheat, and the penalties are there. She's got to accept it, and everybody's got to move on. You know, should have cheated. That's all there is to it. And, you know, now she's going to have to pay the price.
Let me start this conversation by, you know, disclosing to the audience that we have 7, 8, 9 horses with Linda. You know, she's our trainer in New York, and she's had a good string of horses for us for a number of years. Over the course of those years, I've gotten to know her very well. She's extremely hardworking. She devotes a tremendous amount of time to racing, not only to her own stable, but she's on boards of nonprofits. She's on the NYFA board to try to make the industry a better industry overall for the people and the athletes that are involved. And Bill, to your point, that all pales in comparison to, if she cheated, then she deserves to get penalized and you know, ultimately have, be under scrutiny. And I'm fully endorsing and agree that with that 100%. That being said, it boggles my mind that she gets a 3-year suspension, basically. And the monetary fine is $50,000 is a lot of money, but in comparison to the 3 years, that's really the teeth of the sentence in this case. It shocked me that it was 3 years when you compare it to, people who are convicted of drugging a horse or of, more importantly, putting a horse and the human athletes in peril by, blocking a horse or by using medications that mask pain. So a horse runs and could potentially, be either hurt himself or be a fatal incident and also hurt the people that are around the horse. So that inconsistency, as Joe put it, is that's what really is throwing me in this situation. Again, I can go into detail as far as whether or not, the Naira Racing should have given the 3 years. The penalties are the penalties. So I guess, they're kind of the rule makers and they're the ones that are implementing this kind of a penalty. That being said, they never disclosed exactly what the rule was that she broke, because if it was a bribery situation, then she would have gone to federal court because she's effectively bribing an official. So it wasn't that. And they never really gave a reason as to what exactly constituted, the improper and corrupt conduct. And that's really, not to be a lawyer, but that's really where, this issue is going to fall, is what is constituted as corrupt and consistent. Again, as somebody who owns horses, we get calls and inquiries all the time, almost on a weekly basis. Hey, can you run this horse in this race? Hey, we got this horse, this race has got 4. We'll make it go with 5. Well, who's in there? Oh, well, Sacco's got a horse and Contessa's got a horse and this guy's got a horse. And you know who the horses are because you can look it up in the Thorough Manager program, or you can look it up on Racing Form and get an idea. Or even better yet, you call the jockey agents because they know everything that's going on in the racing office and they can tell you exactly who's going to be in the race. So the information is a little more public than what they're making it out to be. And I think, Joe, you mentioned that before. I mean, the biggest joke in racing is whenever you're going to run a horse in a stake race and they say, you call up and you say, hey, I'm thinking about putting a horse in this race. What's it looking like? It's going to be 5 or 6 horses. You'll make 6 or 7. And there's a couple out of towners and a claimer that wants to get black type. And then the entries come out and you're in a 12 horse field. I actually fully expected the Kentucky Derby for them to call me and say, there's 5 or 6 horses in the race. You should put helium in there. But that's kind of the running gag of it all. So, everyone knows who's going to be in the races pretty much. So it's not just a super trainer gets this information and a lowly person who only has 2 or 3 horses doesn't get the information. You can get the information pretty readily. And as far as the bribe part of it, that again doesn't really fit the narrative. Linda gave, if you're going to bribe somebody, the best way to do it is you're going to give them cash. You're going to give them something that's untraceable, and you're going to do it once in a while when you need information. Linda gave checks to everyone in the racing office, all of the officials, all of the valets, and all of the gate crew. So it wasn't like it was one person or one group of people. She gave them money. She gave them checks. She did it at the end of the year as a Christmas bonus. And she did it for years and years and years. So it wasn't like it was, we're going to start in this year because I'm getting information that I shouldn't. Again, all that aside, the ruling was that she did something that was improper and against the greater good of the industry. And if she had a password from one of the racing offices, officers, and that's how she got the information, then to me, that's the reason why she should have a penalty, not because she allegedly bribed people, because she really didn't, or not because of any of the other things that we talked about. But if she took advantage of information that the other people in the racing office or the other people in racing didn't have, and that is, by having access to this code, then she does deserve a penalty of some sort.
John, can I step in? Because I'd like to, now I'm going to interview you. Have you guys taken the horses away from Linda yet?
No, we haven't, because basically there's an appeal process that's going to go on. And just like with the split sample, we're waiting to see how the appeal process plays out. So we're not going to make any kind of determination of saying that she's innocent or guilty until we get through this appeal process.
then let's say for the sake of argument that she is found guilty after the end of the appeal, she takes 3 years off. She's young enough. She can come back and have, you know, a career. You know, as we're talking about what will happen to Bob Baffert, maybe you guys haven't thought this through, but Linda Rice is back 2024. Would you support her?
That'd be tough to do, Bill, because I think if she genuinely broke the rules and went through this process and then went through an appeal process, which the appeal process is actually going to be through the New York court system. So you know, then it's really the big stakes at that point. And if it looks like that she's guilty at that point, you can't give horses back to somebody like that, because then they were found guilty not only in a court of their own peers, but also in the courts of New York. And that would be impossible to give somebody, you know, an opportunity to train horses again when they were found, you know, basically guilty in two different venues.
Right. And, you know, this was kind of a long process. You know, this was an investigation that goes back several years. The hearings got delayed as well because of COVID last year. So this was something that was a long time in the making. I wonder, you know, and John, feel free if you don't want to divulge this, but I wonder if Linda was expecting this, because I was shocked that she got this kind of suspension. And I couldn't believe it when I first read the news, but I wonder, like, what's the precedent for this kind of thing? Like what was she expecting?
No, and I can't speak for Linda, but I know from talking to her, that this was a shock. It was a shock that it was this long of a duration. You know, the fine, again, not that $50,000 isn't a lot of money, but in the grand scheme of things, that's not the important part of this sentence. It's the 3 years. And if you think about it, you know, trainers are drugging horses and getting caught, and they get, you know, basically slaps on the wrist, or they're allowed to train horses at other racing venues. You know, here, her license is revoked. And if it's revoked, it's not just revoked in New York, it's revoked everywhere. She can't train anywhere as a licensed trainer. She's not even allowed on the grounds technically. So she couldn't be like a jock agent or you know, some venues, some racing jurisdictions may not even let her own horses, because technically she would be found guilty of against rules and regulations of racing. So, you know, it really would put her way behind the eight ball if this is, you know, through the Court of Appeals, if it is upheld. She's basically going to have to, you know, do something outside of the immediate racetracks. Now her family has, they pinhook, they have, you know, property in Ocala, and they've certainly been very successful. Racehorse Stable, you know, Stable is a great pinhooking operation, that I believe it's her nephew that's involved. And obviously, another family member is the breeder of Matina Spirit. So, you know, the Rice family goes way back in the horse industry, and you know, there's a lot of different levels that they play in, and a lot of different, you know, roles that they play. And I think Linda ultimately is going to end up on her feet if she has to go to a different you know, opportunity or you know, and do a different job. But as far as training goes, I mean, you know, if you're out for 3 years and you come back, I'm sure it's going to be, you know, really, really difficult for her to come back. I will say that, and I'll disclose, you know, probably something I shouldn't, but I don't think Linda would mind. You know, when I called her after I heard the news and talked to her about it, and basically said, look, we're going to wait to make any kind of decision until after the appeal process is over. I hope that's, you know, that you understand that's in support of you. Otherwise, you know, we'd be moving him immediately. And she said, no, basically all of my owners have reached out to me and said that they're supporting me through this process. And until the appeal process is done, they're keeping horses with me. So it was, you know, that was refreshing to hear that at least, you know, there's some support in that sense. And again, Linda's won a bunch of races for people. And you can look up our stats, you know, she hasn't won a race for us in a couple of months. But I just feel that as an individual, I have that much confidence in her as a person and the kind of things that she does, that I think that the sentence doesn't match the crime in this situation.
That's my feeling too, is I don't want to get up here and make excuses for Linda. She broke the rules. She should be punished. My only thing is keep that same energy for the drug trainers. You know, that is the issue to me, is that is the incongruity of the punishment. I'm not going to, like I said, I'm not going to say that Linda didn't do something wrong and shouldn't be punished, but where is that kind of energy for the drug trainers? Because those are the people that you know, are ruining the sport in terms of putting horses at risk. And, you know, like we've seen, it can blow up in a big race and, you know, kind of destroy the integrity of the sport, whatever's left of it in a lot of people's minds. So Linda broke the rule. She should be punished, but so should the guys who are cheating in a way that's, I think, more impactful on the day-to-day health of the industry.
Right. And Joe, one more thing, and I think this is kind of an interesting aside. So Linda's win percentage over that window that they were looking at was like 17%. And in the races that she, entered horses in, because of the information that she got, her win percentage was 12%. So her win percentage wasn't even good in the races where she had, you know, maybe some inside information. And again, not that matters, because the win percentage isn't the important thing. But I just thought it was interesting that, like, you know, it didn't give her the advantage that people think it did. But that being that it said, if she broke the rule, she broke the rule, and she should be punished for it.
We'll be right back after this message from the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project.
It's said that life is simply a series of memories we share with the ones we love. The experiences, the joys, the thrills. Imagine a life that includes meeting your very own racehorse for the first time. The thrill of watching your racehorse passing others one by one down this stretch, and then sharing the winner's circle celebration with those closest to you. Let the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project help guide you to the experiences and memories you deserve. Owning a racehorse is less expensive and more attainable than you think. Visit racehorseminnesota.com. That's racehorseminnesota.com, and begin making your memories this summer at Canterbury Park.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is the man of the hour. We appreciate him making some time to come talk to us. Michael McCarthy, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
So it's great to have you. I'm sure your phone's ringing off the hook this week. You got your first Triple Crown win this week with your first Triple Crown runner in Rombauer. This is kind of a cliche question, but we saw that you had some raw emotion in the winner's circle. I wonder what was going through your mind from when the horse crossed the wire to when you walked down to the winner's circle. What were you thinking of other than, oh my God, I just won the Preakness?
You know, to be honest with you, when the horses come into the quarter pole, I was getting excited. And almost in a little bit of disbelief. The first thought that went through my head, you know, all right, well, the horse had carried himself to the quarter pole. At least I can say he put up a respectable performance in a Triple Crown race. But when they straightened up for home and Flavian wheeled outside and they were three across the track, I could see the other two guys inside of him working, and Flavian still looked like he was in a little bit of a rhythm and hadn't really gotten after him all that aggressively yet. It's almost like my world went silent from the quarter pole to the wire. Just watching that horse get in a rhythm when he did strike the front, was kind of pulling away from those horses. It was almost like, I've mentioned a couple of times, it was like an out of body experience. And then sure enough, when they hit the wire and you kind of snap back to reality, I kind of looked around, and unfortunately, just because of quarantine protocols at my daughter's elementary school, she wasn't able to travel. So you're there by yourself and you're kind of looking for someone to fist bump, high five, hug, do whatever with. And it was a little bit of a melancholy moment for a quick second there, walking down to the racetrack. Was lucky enough, obviously, to be greeted by my former employer, Todd Pletcher. That was the closest thing I had to family there. So it made it all worthwhile.
Hey, Michael, thanks for joining us. And this is one of those what if questions, but I'm sure you've been asked this before, and you're probably asking yourself, as well as he ran in the Preakness, any regrets about not running in the Kentucky Derby?
I had spoke to John and Diane a couple of times. They were bullish on passing the Derby. Unfortunately, I was bullish on running in the Derby. I had thought all along that a mile and a quarter would be right in this horse's wheelhouse. He's a horse that, he's got three things going for him. He's very intelligent. He's got a great set of lungs on him. and he seems to want to run as far as they'll write races. Churchill Downs, that racetrack is hard and fast, somewhat similar to like the synthetic racetrack that we would have seen at Golden Gate Fields in the El Camino Real. I kept on having kind of visions of that year Orb won the Kentucky Derby when he was came from out of the clouds. Obviously the Mind That Bird scenario. I thought he was a horse that would come from out of it. The last couple of years, John's felt that the speed's just been too good in these Triple Crown races, particularly the Derby. But I thought he had one thing going for him, and that a mile and a quarter would be no issue at all. So yes, it was a little bit regretful we didn't get to try our hand in the Kentucky Derby. These things, sometimes they have a way of working themselves out, but I was very keen to run in the Derby.
And Michael, when you're campaigning a horse of his caliber, are you looking down the road and saying, okay, I'm working backwards from the Breeders' Cup Classic, or I'm working backwards from this $1 million race? Or, you know, give us an idea of what's going through your mind when you talk to the owners about next steps for this colt.
Our strategy was a little bit unconventional. It had been my intention to run the horse right out of his own stall a couple of times here at Santa Anita. The horse had a 90-day working break after the Breeders' Cup, went to the El Camino Real Derby, found himself way, way, way out the back that day. Can't thank Kyle Frey enough for doing a wonderful job in getting that horse's nose down at the wire, or maybe none of this is possible. But we kind of played a lobbying game a little bit subsequently after the El Camino Real Derby. The Frackens had an idea in their mind that they wanted to go to the Wood Memorial. It might be the easiest race. The Santa Anita Derby they thought was too tough. The Bluegrass was paceless. Not sure exactly how we kind of ended up going to the Bluegrass, but sure enough, on paper, through all the analytics that we had gone through, the race was basically paceless on paper. So his hand was a little bit forced, he needed to lay a little closer that day in the Bluegrass. I'm not sure if it took a little starch out of him, but hit a flat spot around the turn and came running on through the lane. But yeah, back to what you were saying, I would have preferred to run right out of his own stall. Even in the Santa Anita Derby, I thought he would have gotten a wonderful pace scenario, you know, something to close into in the stretch here. It's water under the bridge now.
So what's coming next for him? Is he on track for the Belmont after that? Do you think in Travers? What are you thinking now?
Horses at Belmont Park. He's currently stable with Jonathan Thomas there. I'll head back there in the next couple of days. The Belmont is definitely on the radar. I thought the other day he was running underneath the wire. You weren't seeing a tired horse. Yeah, I think you were seeing a horse that was in a rhythm. Showed that probably the added distance wouldn't be an issue. You know, unfortunately, in the way these things are set up right now, with the winner of the Kentucky Derby, his status in limbo as far as being the winner of the Kentucky Derby. So far, you'd have to go ahead and put him kind of at the head of the class. If he was able to get lucky enough and jump up and win the third leg of the Triple Crown, have a two-nothing lead to any of the other three-year-olds in this division that have actually crossed the finish line first, you'd have to think he'd have a healthy start on possibly, you know, what could be a championship type season. Those are all big ifs, big asks, but it's very good to be in a position like this.
Hey, Michael, look at the back of the Prius on paper. This horse for a handicap was hard to come up with, particularly because of the speed figures. His buyer figures were not up to par with some of the best horses in the race. So it looks like he improved easily 8-9 lengths from his previous start. But I seem to think that you expected that all along, and it worked out exactly what you hoped for. What have you seen that made you so confident he was ready to run the race of his life?
When we sent him to San Francisco for the El Camino Real, I thought the horse was probably at least one work, maybe two works short of really being ready to fire his best race. Fortunately, I think it wasn't the strongest group of horses that we've seen in any of these kind of three-year-old preps here this season. My own opinion is that synthetic numbers are slightly slower than natural dirt surface numbers, and I think that plays into it. I also think that there's a little bit of, you know, I think they also sort of sway with the competition. So his number in the El Camino Real was a little bit light. In the Bluegrass, I thought, as I said, he hit a little bit of a flat spot around the turn. Not sure if it was just second race back and he wasn't quite as sharp as I thought he would be. As a handicapper, you're always looking at progression, and as rule of thumb is, third race off the layoff is your best race. Well, third race off the layoff happened to be the Preakness. Horse had trained exceptional here. His work on the Saturday before the Preakness went 5/8 of a mile, 59-2, galloped out a mile in 139-3 on a racetrack like we're seeing here at Santa Anita right now. This is very, very good. So I was fairly bullish that he would show up and run well. Wasn't fairly bullish that he'd show up and win, but I really thought the horse would give a very good account of himself.
And Michael, you know, you're relatively new in the sense of you've been only have a trainer's license for a short period of time. So to win the Preakness is an outstanding accomplishment. You're just about 1,000 races into your career right now, and already you have 6 or 7 grade one winners. Is there one particular horse in your mind where you stood there and said, you know what, this horse, now I've proven to myself that I've made it as a legitimate trainer?
I kind of thought I had made it as a legitimate trainer when I went out on my own after spending 11 years or whatever it was working for Todd, 11 plus years. You know, you pick up and you leave a locale that you're familiar with, which for me was the Midwest and the Eastern Seaboard. Working for Todd, California is my home. I picked up, came back here, had a lot of reasons. Family was part of it. Was probably the biggest reason. You know, when I got here, I kind of thought my business would take off a little bit better than it had, but it had been so long since I'd been really a regular face in California. It took a little while longer than I thought it would. Aaron Wellman, Eclipse Orbits, they were quick to jump up and support me right from the start. And some faces followed after that. The Warrens were nice enough to send me some horses, but it took me, I think, nearly 7 months to win my first race in California. I think after my first year, I think I had a dozen horses. After my second year, I had 20 horses. So it was a slow build. I wouldn't say I'm probably the best at soliciting business, but I felt like I had arrived when I started out on my own. I felt like I was ready. I wasn't a 20-something-year-old kid. I was in my early 40s. So, I think Saturday was our 11th grade one winner in the last 4 or 5 years here, 5 or 6 individual grade one winners. So it's been a slow grind. Actually, you know, I guess you'd call it a slow grind, but it's been worth it. I wouldn't change anything now. The first 3 years were not real fun, but they were character building. You get introspective. You learn a lot about yourself when things aren't going the right way. So you've got two choices. You either pack up and get out and find something else to do, or you just keep on and keep on pushing. So my feeling was never quit. There's, you know, I heard Tiger Woods say one time that just quitting is not an option. And I strongly believe that. You just got to keep pressing forward.
You mentioned your family and moving out to California and putting down roots there, or re-putting down roots there. Your daughter Stella is a pretty popular little girl in the racing world. Can you talk about kind of what it's been like to kind of look at the racetrack again through her eyes?
She probably knows. She knows a lot about what's going on here in the stable. She always keeps abreast of what we've got going on. She is a horse girl at heart. Fortunately, she's got a lot of things going on. Academic school. She likes to swim on her swim team and stuff like that. So that takes up a lot of her time. But, you know, she obviously had a special connection to a horse or two that we had here. City of Light, when he won the Pegasus, she was pretty beaten up after he was leaving to go on and start the second half of his career. So I think she was in the right place at the right time. Zoe Metz was able to capture a wonderful photograph of her as we were saying goodbye. But she's a familiar face around the barn here in the afternoons. We'd like to kind of mix it up at feed time. And she, you know, she knows a little bit about every horse, and we are slowly bringing her along. I don't know if this is the chosen profession or the chosen path for her. I think it might be a little bit difficult. We've got some things we'd like to go ahead and have her get a college education and maybe see where her swimming teacher, but yeah, she's pretty well known around here.
Yeah, that's an uphill climb once you've introduced them to the racetrack, for sure.
And Mike, obviously you got a very good education working for Todd Pletcher, but could you go into some, you know, specifics? What are the two or three things that you learned under Todd that you apply to your own training career now?
I said this the other day. I don't think if you're around Todd, he leads by example. He shows up. He gives it his best every day. He's got some things that I think he does better than anybody, or better than anybody that I've been around. You know, his attention to detail, his organizational skills, his big picture kind of thinking, you know, bypass this one, we'll get him the next one. This is something that he set out to do, as I read when he finally found out he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. He had said to his parents at 12 or 13 that he'd like to be a racehorse trainer. So when you've got someone that's dedicated the last two-thirds of, you know, last 25, 30 years of their life, like Todd had, to training racehorses, obviously he's left no stone unturned. And just the way he handles himself, it doesn't take thousands of races won. It doesn't take championships. It doesn't take Triple Crown races to see the kind of person he is. So I think anyone that spent a lot of time around Todd and that's gone on and trained, George Weaver, Jonathan Thomas, myself, a few others, you know, I think we've kind of seen what it takes. Certainly everybody's got their own mold, but you pick up where Todd kind of, I'm not going to say it's everything we do kind of vicariously goes through what we learned during our time at Todd's. Probably the best way I could put it, you know. It would take this podcast and a couple others to go through it all.
No, we appreciate that. Michael, one more question for me, and that is, you mentioned, you know, the Todd Pletcher family tree, in essence, the training tree. And you've mentioned you and George Weaver and Jonathan Thomas. And I think as an industry, you know, we look at that training tree and say they're doing it the right way. They do things the right way. They're horsemen and their horses come in and look the part and run the way they should run. You know, now with Heisa and everything coming into play, give the our audience an idea of what you feel like Heisa is going to do and if you're in favor of it.
I've read enough about it. I don't know. I'm a little bit, I'm both ways. I definitely think we need a unified body. I think we need unified rules. Each racing jurisdiction is different. HBPA has one view. California Thoroughbred Trainers and the TOC, I'm sure they have another view. Racetrack managements throughout the country are all sort of, you know, I don't have a problem with it. If everybody's on board and everybody's doing the same thing, well, then I think it's only a win for everybody.
Gotcha. Agreed. All right, Michael, thank you so much for the time. Congratulations again on the big win and good luck the rest of the year with the big horse.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mike. We'll be rooting for you. Thanks, Michael.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much for making that easy. That was great.
You got it. No problem. Anytime.
Try to make it painless.
This isn't my thing. I prefer the company of none. So doing all this kind of stuff is a little bit overwhelming, you know?
Great. You did great.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Michael McCarthy will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
Before we get out of here, I just wanted to mention yesterday the news broke that Malibu Moon died. He was 24 years old. Obviously, he was the horse that really built Spendthrift Farm into the juggernaut that it is now in the modern era. Obviously, Into Mischief came along and took them to the next level. But Malibu Moon, I think, gave them a lot of credibility for a lot of years to kind of stay afloat until Into Mischief came along and supercharged the operation. But he was, you know, a phenomenal, phenomenal sire for a long, long time too. He's currently responsible for 126 black type winners, 51 graded stakes winners, 17 grade one winners. That's pretty damn good for a horse that, as far as I know, never stood above beyond like $35,000, $40,000. I think he was always kind of in that middle price range. But he was an interesting sire too, because he didn't really do anything on the racetrack. He was highly touted. He only ran twice, both times at Hollywood Park for Mel Studi back in the late 90s for B. Wayne Hughes. And he only ever won one race. He started his stallion career in Maryland at a Country Life Farm for the Ponzes, and eventually moved on to Spendthrift. But he was one of those horses that I just felt like never kind of got his just due as a top sire, at least not since I've been around. But he was just a stalwart, is how I would put it. And, you know, he was, even though he was overshadowed in later years by Into Mischief, he was still very popular and still could produce a bunch of really good horses. So rest in peace to Malibu Moon, and sorry to everybody who took care of him at Spencer. But there were some interesting quotes in today's TDN about it from some of the people that were hands-on with Malibu Moon. I wonder if John has any thoughts.
I really always was enamored with Malibu Moon. I thought that he was a great sire. I thought that he was great value. And every year we would always end up with one or two Malibu Moons in our stable, primarily because they were like hickory. They ran, they were sound. And even though he himself, like you said, Joe, only ran twice in his entire career, his foals were usually pretty sound. They could run on all surfaces. They could run all distances. And again, every year we ended up, you know, kind of by accident with a bunch of them on our short list at the various sales. And every year we would breed, you know, a mare to them, because if we had an older mare, we wanted to have a filly out of, you know, that was by Malibu Moon to kind of keep the family line going. And if it turned out to be a colt, it was a great yearling prospect to sell. So he was always on our short list of horses to look at. We would breed something to him every year. And I think he was just kind of a steady Eddie. He was like a Mine Shaft or the Factor, or just these good, solid horses that you don't necessarily go looking, you know, to the sales and going through your catalog, you know, looking for one necessarily. But there were always a couple of them that ended up on your short list to potentially buy. And the thing that always impressed me about Malibu Moon, and Joe, you mentioned this before, is that, you know, he wasn't a sexy horse in the sense of like he was going to be super expensive. And I think the one year where he was standing for more than $50,000 was right after Orb won the Kentucky Derby. He jumped up in price just for that one year or so. But otherwise, he was just a really solid horse. And whenever we looked for steady Eddies that we wanted to see if a mare was a proven, you know, commodity or not, if we should keep her around or not, we would always breed one to Malibu Moon just to see what happened. I mean, quite frankly, it was, you know, he was like the Bill Finley of stallions.
Wow. What am I to make of that, John?
I don't even know where to go with that, John. Yeah.
Just like every year, you know, Bill, you're kind of steady Eddie, and every year you jump up and throw a really good article out there.
And just to touch on a couple of his best runners, he had the Eclipse Champion, 2 year old Declan's Moon back in the day. He had Orb, who was his Derby winner. He had a dual grade one winner, Gormley, who stands at Spendthrift, who I think might carry on his legacy. And then 3-time grade one winner, Devil May Care, multiple grade one winner, Moonshine Memories. He's also been a pretty good broodmare sire. He was the broodmare sire of Midnight Bourbon, who was the runner up in the Preakness on Saturday. So yeah, he definitely leaves a legacy for sure. And I also wanted to mention a pioneer that we lost last week as well. On the human side, was Len Ragason, who died last week at the age of 92. And if you don't know about Len Ragason, he created the Ragason Sheets, which I think really changed the way people handicap horse races, because he went beyond the buyer speed figure, where you're just analyzing a raw number compared to other raw times, and he factored in all sorts of stuff: weight, ground loss, wind speed. It was kind of the precursor to the thoroughgraph sheets, which are very popular right now, and a ton of guys, obviously, so many top owners and handicappers use the Ragusan sheets still to this day. He sold his company at one point and used the money to start the Len Ragusan Foundation, which donates a lot of money to progressive causes. He's a super interesting guy. If you want to go, there's an old New York Times profile of him when he was first starting to have success as a horse better with his system. It's really fascinating. I suggest you go check it out. But he was one of the guys that I think kind of made betting the horses, he made it easier for people to get an edge betting the horses, which is a very, very difficult thing to do. And there were only a handful of people that I think have really done that in a long-standing way over time. And Len Ragusan was one of those people. So he'll go down in history as one of the guys who really changed speed handicapping forever. And that's a big deal to horse players like me. So rest in peace to Len. The TDN Writers Room is also sponsored by Legacy Bloodstock. At Legacy Bloodstock, Tommy and Wendy Eastham don't sell their own horses, which means no conflict of interest when asked by a prospective buyer to show them their best horses. They don't think about what's best for them. They're here to work for you. We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse. Every step of the way, when it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by the J.P. Morgan Private Bank, a proud sponsor of the Writers Room podcast. For over 200 years, they've helped successful individuals and families achieve their unique ambitions. To learn more about them and explore becoming a client, visit privatebank.jpmorgan.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Michael McCarthy, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Ritz, and our editors, Aaliyah LaRocca and Anthony LaRocca. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next week.